Ladies and gentlemen, this session we have three speakers to help us uncover fintech. We have Eric Heller, who is a partner at EY Sweeney. That's EY's market research and customer insights group. As well as Eric's regular work with our clients, he produces market research to back up thought leadership, including two on fintech, one in Australia and one globally. Next to Eric is Stuart Stoyan. Stuart is the current chair of Fintech Australia. Stuart is an entrepreneur and a founder and CEO of MoneyPlace, and also the founder of the Fintech Census, which Eric has worked on with Fintech Australia. Stuart is also a champion of good customer outcomes. Next to Eric is Rod Maddock. Rod is a professor at Monash University and also a past head of strategy at CBA, so has some view of fintech from a big organisation's perspective. Rod has written numerous papers and articles, including some on fintech. Without further ado, I want to introduce the first speaker, Eric Heller, who's going to talk to us about some of these fintech trends that he's uncovered.
Hi everyone. Thanks for coming along to the session today. It's quite loud. We'll have a very thought-provoking session. I think we'll have quite different perspectives from all the three speakers. I'll kick us off with a very high-level view. I've got two studies where I'd like to share the findings with you today. The first one is a global study across 20 markets called EY FinTech Adoption Index. And the second one, as Steve mentioned, is the FinTech Australia Census, which Stuart originally founded and EY and EY Sweeney have been fortunate enough to run with FinTech Australia for the last few years. I'll start with the FinTech Adoption Index. It's a study we've run a couple of times now. We're looking at running it again later this year or next year, and it's been started to really help us understand what traction fintech companies are getting in the market. You know, when we started in 2015, there's a lot of hype around fintech, and we wanted to set something in place to really understand where it's making an impact with consumers. So it's a fairly large-scale study with over 20,000 interviews across 20 countries, and it looks at fintech across sort of five different buckets. It looks at money transfer and payments, insurance, savings and investments, financial planning, and also the borrowing or lending side of things. When we talk about adoption, we're really looking at people who are regular users of fintech rather than people who've, you know, used PayPal once to pay for something, but rather people who, you know, use at least two of these different types of fintechs in the last 6 months or every 6 months. The other thing to appreciate about this particular study is that it's only focused on digitally active consumers. So while in Australia or the UK, that's virtually everyone, in some countries like China and India who've got in our study, that represents a smaller proportion of the market. So what did we find in this study? In comparison to 2015, we found that the fintech uptake or adoption had accelerated quite substantially and really reached what we call initial mass adoption stage, which based on academic innovation theory is defined as sort of roughly 16 to 50% of a target market taking up an innovation. But what you can see is that there's quite a broad band of you know, adoption levels across these different countries, ranging from 13% for Belgium and Luxembourg, all the way to almost 7 in 10 digitally active consumers having adopted fintech in China. Australia, if you can spot it, is fairly close to the average at 37% there. In 2015, the study was a little bit smaller, so we've only got a few comparative markets there. But what we can see is that the adoption has really, over that 18 to 24-month period, doubled, or in some cases almost tripled, such as Australia, really accelerated the growth of fintech. Other markets, such as Hong Kong, it's a bit of a different story, but the adoption levels, even in 2015, were already very high there. What's driving this strong growth? There's really two elements to this. There's a supply side element and a demand side element. From a supply side point of view, what we've really seen across this period is really an explosion of the number of fintechs active, both in the Australian market. We had a little stat there on an earlier slide. 2016, we estimated there was about 250 fintechs in Australia. In 2017, so 12 months later, it's over 600. So it's a much larger number of players active in the market. The second element to it is there's a much bigger range of services and in different types of products out there from a fintech, opening up additional markets that people can take up. When comparing the two periods, 2015 to 2017, you can see money transfers and payments has had the biggest increase by far, going from 18% to 50%, and it continues to be the biggest category. A lot of that increase is driven by big technology players getting into that space. A classic example is Alipay in China, which has achieved a tremendous adoption level in a very, very short period of time. And so some of the other tech giants like Facebook and so on play a part in that as well. Another big mover is insurance, which actually jumped from one of the smaller categories to being the second in the market there, sort of driven by comparison sides, wearable tech, telematics and so on. From a demand side, there are two elements again. One is more the sort of demographic side of things, and the other is a behavioural, attitudinal perspective. From a demographics, it's perhaps not so surprising to see a younger demographic, although not the youngest demographic, having the highest adoption rates. And that's the 25 to 34-year-olds where the adoption levels are highest, due to both being a very digitally savvy audience, but also having a real need for financial services products, which is perhaps not as prevalent for the 18 to 24-year-olds. You can imagine if you're at university, you have a few financial needs. It's really only when you start earning real money that you need mortgages, et cetera, and have investment products and so on. The other element with that younger audience is coming through is a much stronger trust in these technology companies and a much stronger relationship with them from an early age, whereas traditional financial services companies, their runway of a trusting relationship isn't as long for these audiences. From an attitudinal point of view, when we compared those who are regular users of fintech to those who weren't, what we found, there was an innate desire to manage their lives digitally, not just financial services, but more broadly. We see the same in health, interaction with government services and so on. There's a real predisposition to organise a range of aspects of your life digitally, and in particular on mobile, which of course has some real ramifications for interface design and the user experience that's being created. Another interesting finding was a real focus on convenience, and Stuart, the champion of customer experience, will I'm sure talk about that a bit more. But people are willing to some extent to pay a bit of a premium for a good customer experience and convenience. However, cost will always be a factor when taking up fintech kind of services at the expense of products by established players. Um, starting to look ahead, we've asked people how likely they are to keep using fintech products or start using fintech products more regularly. While the individual numbers might be a little bit hard to see on this, you can see the dark grey bar on the right-hand side of each of these little series. You can see strong positive momentum for each of these countries. And while the exact level of those numbers, there might be a little bit of variability in those, but generally we see it as evidence of strong positive sentiment towards an innovation or a category. If people indicate they are likely to use it more in the future. If we look at these five categories of fintechs as well, we can see that that sentiment carries through to each of them, and particularly for some of the smaller ones, we expect them to almost double in terms of uptake from consumers over the next 6 to 12 months or so. So analysing this data, there is a suggestion that fintech globally will actually reach the late majority stage of adoption and become a real mass market product or industry. Going from the 33% average adoption that we have at the moment, well, we might lose a little bit in terms of the lapses. The people who are currently only using one service or the current non-users are likely to drive us up past that 50% mark and keep us there for some time. A lot of these increases are further supported by the barriers to adoption that we've identified both in 2015 and 17. Are really evaporating very quickly. In 2015, we still saw a lack of awareness of fintech services out there in a lot of the countries and a lot of the categories. However, as you can see in a lot of these data series, here, that's really dropping away quite significantly in most of these markets. And a preference for keeping with the traditional financial services providers is coming much more to the fore. As a barrier for further fintech adoption. Now, some of those hesitations of adopting fintech and preferring traditional providers are probably related to the trust or the lack of trust in the new kids on the block that fintechs are to some people. However, with more time in the market, naturally that trust will build up as well. Certain other barriers, underlying barriers, such as a lack of convenience of having to switch for different products to different providers, is probably also something that's going to get addressed by the fintech industry itself once we get stronger open data regimes in Australia. Okay, I'll move on to the second study now, which is the Fintech Australia Census. It's a collaboration of Fintech Australia and EY, and as Steve mentioned earlier, Stuart was actually the founder of that study some time ago, so he might say a few words on that later on as well. But I'll take you through some of the latest findings of that study very quickly now. I'm not sure how I'm going for time. Not that well, by the way, Steve looking at me. The Fintech Australia study was really created to help us create a bit of a fact base for an industry that was at the time fairly nascent, and we wanted to help define it. We wanted to understand how big it was, who was operating in it, as well as identify some of the challenges of it and cast a bit of a light forward of where it might be headed. And here is actually that number. In 2016, we had 250 fintechs in Australia, and at the time of this last study, it was about 600, so I expect it to actually be some more now. I've got a few fast facts here on this infographic. I won't go through all of them. But what many of the numbers highlight is that really over this relatively short one-year period between the 2016 and the 2017 study, which is the latest edition that we have, the industry has matured quite a bit. Almost 8 in 10 of the fintechs have been in existence for 2 years now. And 7 in 10 of them are actually in a revenue-generating phase of their company life cycle now as well, which has moved on quite a bit from 2016. What's interesting to note is that when you look at the type of fintech, we see a strong representation of wealth and investment and lending of fintechs in Australia, which, as you might recall, were some of the smaller categories, certainly not the largest ones in terms of global consumer adoption of fintech. But that links up quite well with who the end customers of Australian fintechs tend to be. We can see a strong representation of B2B with corporates, SMEs, but also government and banks. In addition to charting out the sort of characteristics of the industry, one of the topics that we also discussed with the fintech firms were the key factors that they anticipate will drive their success over the next few years. And there are 5 key factors came up, and in no particular order. There were the talent, environment, demand, capital and policy. So from a talent perspective, you know, the people side of things really emerged as a pressure point for the industry. You know, that's on the backdrop of the majority of fintechs only employing around about 8 people. So very small startup industry, run very lean in many cases. And over half of the fintechs find it quite difficult to attract the right kind of staff, particularly in the engineering software side of things. Related to you know, the size of their organisations is a challenge around you know, the professional networks that they can build, the sounding boards that they have in a place, the collaboration and so on, which is where fintech hubs, incubators and so really come to the fore. While most of the fintechs we spoke to really attest to the necessity of those, there's only about half of them who've actually been able to access one. So it's good to see that a lot of the state governments are actually coming to the party there and trying to push that agenda forward and creating those kind of co-working spaces. I won't spend too much time on the demand side of things. We've talked about those quite a bit already. From a capital point of view, obviously raising capital is a lifeblood for a startup, and you know, in particular in an industry where only about 14% or so are actually revenue generating. Equally, the capital needs are not really being met for the majority. It's only about 40% who've been able to meet their capital needs. So again, an opportunity to support this nascent industry a little bit better. And for any kind of startup environment, policy will play a key role, and I'm sure Stuart and Rod will touch on that as well. I'll wrap up. Despite all of those challenges, and you know, they'll be there for any kind of startup industry, but the fintech community in Australia is very positive and very bullish in their outlook about the future. They feel they're highly competitive internationally, driven in part by the environment that Australia does create, a very strong financial system, the regulatory environment, an openness by ASIC to support a developing industry with sandboxing and so on, but also the access to Asia that we have due to our proximity. And with that, you know, a lot of the fintechs are planning to expand internationally. But of course, that's a double-edged sword. With a lot of, we've got some data from Southeast Asia there. A lot of the Asian fintechs also looking at expanding internationally, which will just create a highly competitive environment. Well, internationally, but here in Australia as well. So I'll hand you over to Rod.
Thanks, Mike.
Thank you.
You sort of hope, don't you? What do you reckon, guys? I'm an investor in two fintechs, so there you go. Anybody who wants to put some more capital into one of them, a payments one, I'm very happy to talk to anybody after the meeting. Did it work? Excellent, thank you. No, top black one, yep. Okay, but I'm going to give a fairly sceptical story today. This is the structure of my talk. It'll be very brief. Basically, the benefits of fintechs are going to be captured by people like me who invest in them, I suspect, rather than people like you, the users, or whoever. That's the interesting question. What's the difference between the private gain from fintechs and the social benefit from fintechs? And that's sort of what I'm trying to address. It comes from a paper that we've been writing for the Australian Centre for Financial Studies. Most of the action in Australia is in lending and payments. The gains in lending mainly occur from extending services, and that's why you saw fintechs take off, let's say, in Kenya and the Philippines and countries with very poorly, and China, countries with very poorly developed markets. You get lots of benefit by providing a service to somebody who doesn't have it initially. But if you're just providing a slightly better service, the gains are much smaller. So especially underdeveloped markets, big gains from extending services. In a market like Australia, where most people have access to most services, we're sort of talking about the second derivative rather than huge gains in levels. The second thing I'm going to talk to you about is about payments. And one of the interesting things about payments is that one of the consequences of the way in which we've reformed payments is that more people are actually using credit. And credit is really expensive. And so socially, we're going for, in a way, from forms of payments which are socially relatively cheap to forms of payment which are much more expensive. Credit's expensive because every time you use your credit card, you're effectively taking out an unsecured loan. Yeah? And you can imagine that builds a set of costs into it. So I'm going to talk about how I'm not convinced that we're making gains in payments yet. And the third one, blockchain, I'm going to talk about briefly. The benefits of blockchain come from anonymous trust. Yeah? That's the guts, that's the big advantage of blockchain. You don't have to know who you're trading with, but you can actually do the deal. Well, it's not very helpful in finance where you have to know your customer. And the whole of the regulatory design around finance is now built around actually being able to trust the person you're transacting with. If you don't know who they are, it's an anonymous relationship, then you can't do that. And so they may be useful, but it's not clear to me how useful they'll be in finance. Okay. This is a piece of work, and if you can't read the bottom horizontal axis, it starts in 1880 and finishes in 2020. It's a paper by a guy called Philippon, published in the American Economic Review. And what this tries to do is to say, what does a unit of financial services cost, and how has that changed over the last 140 years? And it turns out that it's flat. We actually have made all those productivity gains, ATMs and all these sorts of things that you know about, how wonderful they are, the benefits have been captured very largely by the people who work in the banks and their shareholders, and very few of the benefits have been passed on. The unit cost of financing has not fallen over the last 140 years. So fintechs are going to be great for people who are the investors. It's not clear they're going to be great for the people who are actually using the services. And that sort of drives... It's a very, very interesting paper if you want to go and have a look at it. In the American Economic Review, it's also, I think, a version of it in Journal of Economic Perspectives. Okay, lending and payments dominate finance. The top table here is from the Financial Services Inquiry. It just looks at the size of the profit pools in the financial sector in Australia. And you can see that banking dominates $36 billion out of about $60 billion, and insurance is $14 billion. Payments is a very, very small share of the profit pool, just $1 billion in profit in payments. And if you just try to take a simple ratio of profit over revenue, you can see the biggest markups are in banking and in wealth and infrastructure, but payments and insurance actually have lower markups. This is research that I think BCG did originally for the for Australian Super. And the second table is one which comes out of a paper from 2016, and just looks at the sorts of businesses, and you can just see that financing and payments have dominated the business. And so that's, to some extent, why we've chosen to look at those two cases in our research. Okay. What's the value of having households able to borrow more? The answer is very little. We've already got highly indebted households in Australia. If there was a big growth in household borrowing, I suspect the Reserve Bank would raise interest rates to squeeze it down. And so the idea of making it easier for people to borrow more money, it's not quite clear what the social benefits are if they're all going to be offset by increases in interest rates. So the interesting thing about additional lending is there are a group of firms, about 10%, who apparently should get finance and actually don't. So just as you talk about in Kenya or in the Philippines, the big gains are from people getting access to a service who didn't have it before. The interesting thing about lending is how big is this pool of people that you might, businesses in particular, smaller businesses, that might get access to finance through these alternative lending vehicles who don't have access at the moment. About 10% of people. Our estimates, we might increase business lending by about $10 billion and the potential increase in annual value, EBIT, by about $5 billion. So probably increased lending in Australia to customers is not going to make very much difference, but small businesses might make about $5 billion worth of difference. So that's not to be sneezed at. Australia's GDP is, what, about $1.6 trillion, something like that. So $5 billion's... Quick, I need an actuary. Small, thank you. Okay. That's what he says about operational risk as well. Okay, so look, I'm just quickly talking about payments. The chart on the left comes from a Reserve Bank. They both come from Reserve Bank papers. I didn't put the source on this one, sorry. The one on the left shows you that the very, very rapid growth in payments has been in debit cards. But credit has actually been growing really strongly as well. So checks are disappearing, direct credit, debit, BPAY, etc. in there. The chart on the right-hand side shows you the resource costs of these different of a typical transaction in these different forms. So cash, FPOS, BPAY are all around about the same value, social resource cost to do a typical transaction. Debit's a little bit higher, but not too much. But credit is very, very expensive. So if we actually go from using cash to using credit, socially we're incurring an extra 80 cents of costs in undertaking that transaction. And so on the left-hand side, you can see the credit's been growing really quickly. So you can see my concern that as we move away from cash and FPOS perhaps and debit cards towards credit, the rapid growth of credit, it actually means the change is actually negative for the society, yeah? Generating net negative social worth. So there's a convenience value, and in the paper I discuss convenience value. The convenience value is about a quarter of the social cost of the losses due to the growth of credit. So yes, convenience is important, customers do value it, and you save about 14 seconds, I think it is, by using a tap rather than interacting with a pin or something like that. But it turns out the value of that is less than the additional social cost of using the using credit. Blockchain, I only have one slide. The top one is Santander. This is the optimist view of the world. And our analysis suggests that distributed ledger technology will reduce banks' infrastructure costs in those areas by $15 to $20 billion per annum. That's globally. I don't actually think that's a very big number, but that's a Santander's number. But read the second one. All right, I'm not a big fan of blockchain. It may work, and SWIFT is where everybody says it's going to be the big intervention, is actually in that sort of place. That's Ripple's story and all that sort of stuff. But if people are going to keep their information confidential, it's actually going to lead to very, very big additional back offices in all the people who are using the system. And that's only 28 banks. You can imagine all the cross pairs. If you have 1,500 banks, I don't know. Again, I should ask an actuary, how many cross pairs are there in 1,500? Anyway, how many additional ledgers? Quite a lot I got that time. Okay. So, look, my conclusions are fintech is certain to improve productivity in finance. But most of the benefits will be captured by insiders, both incumbents and entrants. And that's why I'm an investor in the sector, obviously. Public policy should be trying to focus on how do we get the benefits passed through. And pro-competitive policy, which you normally, as an economist anyway, think of the obvious way to do it, is very constrained by a whole lot of prudential concerns. And so how you trade off trying to get the benefits passed through when all the many of the major institutions are severely constrained by the prudential regulator is going to be the interesting public policy challenge. Thank you very much.
Now I was just going to check, can I walk with this? Is this mic going to pick it up? I can't actually see the desk. That's a nod. Excellent. Thank you very much for that. And as both founder of MoneyPlace but also chair of FinTech Australia, I guess that makes me the ultimate insider. So, Rod, I kind of like where your presentation went. But now for the rebuttal. The rebuttal from a guy who gets to wear jeans and a T-shirt and sneakers, for those of you who can see my feet, which is the joy. Just to get a sense, though, from the audience, show of hands, how many people work in financial services? I'm assuming everybody. How many people work in a major bank, Big Four bank? There's a few, only a couple. That comforts me because there's a few jokes later on. How many people work in a fintech? Yes, yes, yes. That's great. That is so encouraging to see. Video before this, they sort of said, what's your message to the group? My message is, the grass is greener on the other side, and I hope to see more actuaries working in fintech in the next 12 months than do today. So we'll do that next time. So here we go. So let's just talk about financial services and banking specifically a little bit more broadly, right? Can we truly say that the bank customer outcomes have improved? What are the measures and metrics that we look at for that? From a consumer perspective, 63% of Australians could not easily raise $3,000 in an emergency. So if that is a sort of a sign of sort of financial well-being and a measure on that, I think that sort of says we're failing in that. And source for this is ME Bank's studies around household consumer finance. Next one, then, is that 59% of Australians actually spend more than what they earn. 51% of that actually spend the same amount, money in, money out. 8% of it, scarily, spend more than they earn and are in fact going backwards. So as an overall measure of what is our financial wellness, what's our sort of general well-being for the industry, yeah, I'd say that's sort of showing that we're probably failing our customers. If you look again on the consumer side, you look at the spreads between credit card interest rates, personal loan interest rates, and cash rates. Over the last 25 years, spreads have doubled. Now, where is all that going? That's not going to the end consumer, that's going to bank profitability. You've got credit card products in particular that are running ROEs of over 100%, which is pretty phenomenal if you're a product manager. Kind of sucks balls if you're a consumer. But moving on. From a small business perspective, we talked about access to credit, and Rob put a number of sort of $5 to $10 billion. Almost 6 in 10 small businesses can't actually access the capital they need. So it's not just that consumers are struggling, consumers are being charged a lot, but consumers can't necessarily access, but also small businesses can't access. So then the question then is, you know, what is it that you do about it? To those of you who put your hand up for working in a bank, just a little bit of a heads up, you know, you have been warned. And what we then get to is really this lady. Now, I know that that's pretty disturbing and distressing for some of you, right? But what we've seen through the Royal Commission, and quite frankly, if this is, you know, a coming together of known truths, but it's a synthesis of those known truths in an instant. I'm dead and I'm being charged for, you know, fees for financial services. I'm being charged interest rates that are not appropriate to me and they continue to be charged for me. I'm being gouged on insurance. And it goes on and on and on in terms of sort of the horrors that have been thrown up through that. Now, is that shocking and alarming? Potentially. Is it known? Probably. Is it actually outrageous? Yes, it is. And is there something that we should do about it? So, you know, what does that then sort of mean in terms of what we need to do as an industry, financial services more broadly, and, you know, where is it that we go, you know, from that? And that was kind of where I was at with my presentation. And then, you know, I was thinking, you know, between my usual daily routine of waking up and looking at Twitter and seeing what the Kardashians have been up to, and then now that's been replaced by waking up and seeing what happened in the Royal Commission and what banking scandal is coming up. Over the weekend, ladies and gentlemen, and then there was this, and he clicks the button that doesn't work. The friggin' Dolomites are scamming us. Like, how is it that that is possible, and what is it that's going on? And so then you come up and you move on, you see where the investigation is, and for those of you with eagle eyes, you'll see it's Adele Ferguson. Now, when Adele is lining you up, that gets pretty bad, right? And this is the Dolomites, and specifically, it's these guys. But that said, with the nickname Cred, and that's what's sort of being bandied around to the young children of the world, you kind of sit there and go, well, really, is it a surprise that the Dolomites was a bit of a scam and were kind of trying to take money? I mean, the guy's name is Cred. Yeah, he's into tech and all that sort of stuff, but he's actually maybe not so, unintentionally trying to get behaviors out. So other than beating up on banks and sort of saying banks are horrible and this is the world and fintechs are not banks and therefore fintechs are glorious and that's why it's a great time to be in fintech, what we're actually talking about is customer benefit. So to get some engagement from the audience, this is that we're a personal lender. We provide loans between $5,000 and $45,000. We do this in a way that uses a marketplace lending model. So what we have here is we have investors who fund loans that we then provide to borrowers. Most interestingly and most excitingly, on the borrower side, what we do is we provide personalized interest rates. So what I'd like the audience to do, and this is going to fail tremendously, I'm pretty sure, we're going to get you guys to go in, and people welcomely go in, get an estimate. This is not going to impact your credit score. We're not going to leave a trace on your bureau file, as sort of happened to the banks. We'll talk about that in a minute. But this is to demonstrate the actual tangible customer benefit that exists. In Rod's presentation, and this is a rebuttal, he mentioned that the benefits go to the insiders, it goes to the investors, it goes to the institutions. But actually, I'd posit that the benefit actually goes to the end customer as well. We may not be looking to increase the overall level of lending in Australia, but what we're looking to do is improve customer outcomes. We're looking to help Australians save money. We're looking to provide a better product that actually gives you a personalised interest rate that enables you to save on the amount of money that you pay on your loan. I'm enjoying the fact that a lot of heads are down and people are punching this number. It's about a two-minute process. You need to just go through and answer a few basic questions. You do need your driver's license, and that's probably where everybody goes, oh, all right, too hard. But you should know your driver's license off by heart, I'm pretty sure, right? That's how that works. So we're going to come back to this in a bit, and we're going to see if I can actually demonstrate a point. Disclaimer, I thought it was going to fail tremendously. I want you to prove me wrong, and I want people to go out and do this. So we come and talk about fintech generally, right? So there's this sort of take some of the points that Eric sort of made around this, just to highlight through this in terms of 2017 and what it meant for fintech. So it was a turning point. We talked about the fintech adoption index that EY runs. This tripled from 13% to 37%. So what does this mean? This means that more and more digitally active consumers are using fintech. So the consumers are seeing benefit in that, and that's retail consumers, but also small business consumers as well, right? So the end customer is seeing benefit in it. What we also know is from a broader startup perspective is that fintechs are now basically one in five startups in Australia are in fintech. So consumers are using it. There are more and more startups that are focused on fintech to drive end customer outcome and end customer value. What we also then see is that majority of fintechs are now 2 years older or more. And most importantly, we've seen an increase in terms of their revenue. Of a bit over 200%. So that's a 3x increase in 12 months. So what does this show? This shows that fintechs themselves are maturing. It shows that fintechs are being used by more and more customers, and they're creating real value, real products, and end sort of outcome that is being adopted. Now, it's going to take a little bit of time to get to critical mass, but we're definitely on the way with that. So then we sort of come back to the case study. So a little bit more about just about MoneyPlace, and this is openly a promotion for MoneyPlace, but it gets to the tangible points of customer venue. And there are a number of fintechs I could have put up there. It was just that this was easier and something I'm familiar with. So from a fintech from a MoneyPlace perspective, we have a Trustpilot score of 9.5 out of 10. Trustpilot's a consumer sort of review website. Customers go to it, put sort of reports in there, and that's a 9.5 out of 10. We've got 5-star ratings from sort of Canstar. We've got Mozo Awards. Importantly, we have a Net Promoter Score of 75%. People in the audience familiar with Net Promoter Score and what that means? I will highlight that that is a positive 75% and not a negative 75%, which might be a number that people are more accustomed to in Australian financial services. But what that gets to, though, is this is an indicator, though, of the benefit and value that customers are getting out of just one fintech. But more broadly, this could have been a number of companies that we talked to, and the consumer feedback is generally positive. Why is it positive? It's because it's a personalized service. It's a service that's actually dealing and eliminating some of the friction that exists that sort of makes it a real pain to be able to deal with incumbents and existing institutions. And so what this then comes back to in terms of this is our borrowers at MoneyPlace, on average, save over $5,400 on a personal loan. Now, personal loan average size there is 20 grand. And that's compared to the interest and fees that these customers would pay for a loan with a big four bank. So to sort of the point that was made earlier about the benefits don't actually then pass on to consumers, I think that depends upon what you're looking at in terms of which fintech. And we see very tangibly here that there's a benefit. You'll see that I put my rate estimate up there, and this is my rate estimate. I did this a couple of days ago. So my rate estimate came back at 8.74%. And that's pretty good. Our interest rates run from 7.65% through to sort of low mid-20s. But what that gets to, though, is that, you know, if you actually want a rate that's better than, say, a 15% personal loan rate or a 20% interest, you know, credit card interest rate, you can actually get that. Now, that's not as good as some of our best borrowers, and that's mostly because I mystery shop some of the bank's sort of personal loan products, and that, for various reasons, impairs my credit record. It frustrates me entirely that you can't actually mystery shop in financial services without sort of stuffing up your own credit record, because the presumption is if you ask two people how much for a loan, that straight away becomes credit risk, because clearly, you know, you're not trying to be an informed consumer that's engaging in an activity of price discovery. It means that you're volatile and you're probably a credit risk and you need cash. So if we then come back to the balance of this, right, I'm hoping that a number of you in the audience successfully were able to get a rate estimate. Show of hands, who actually went through and got a rate estimate? We've got a couple. All right, so this is bordering on the, it's going to be a tremendous failure. All right, we're going to do this differently, right? We're going to do this differently. Look to the person to your left. Look to the person to your right. What interest rate do you reckon? Do you reckon you should have got a better interest rate than those people? And I would say with that, let that be your takeaway, right? So we had a handful of people. The way this was going to work was 400 hands were going to go up and say, I got a rate. Then we're going to say, put your hand down if you didn't get an offer. And then we'd all look at the three people who pulled their hand down and we'd go, oh, wow, that's interesting. What actually happened there? But what you'd then see, though, is that over the spectrum of borrowers, for us, we see that the majority of people get a rate that's better than the rate you get from a bank. And that gets to tangible benefit. Now, we're only small, we get scaling and all that sort of stuff. But that, for me, is analogous to the overall fintech industry, which is we're making small incremental gains, demonstrating tangible value and delivering real benefit, both in terms of good customer outcomes, but also in terms of actual tangible sort of dollars that are saved. And what that gets to then is the types of benefits that you'd then be able to expect that can come through from fintech. Now, will banks exist in 10 years? Yeah, they will. Will banks, you know, be put out of business by fintechs? No, they won't. But what we do see is the customer expectations are being redefined by the way that they engage with fintechs. And that's actually leading to a broader proposition that leads to better value that's being added across the board. That's the end of sort of my conclusion, but I think we open up for some questions and we go into a panel. Thank you very much.
So if you have questions, please send them through to the number, use the app, or even come and stand at the microphone. Your questions will appear here, and I'll put them to one or all of the panel. Does anyone want to kick off, or shall I get going? Right, let me throw the first question to you. Rod's told us that costs have not come down so far for consumers. Stuart's shown us an example where his cost came down. I think a few of you, maybe your cost was lower than the bank's. Eric's told us that there are more and more fintechs joining the market, the adoption rate's going up. With that level of competition, interested to hear from the panel, are we going to see lower costs as well as convenience in the future?
Yes, and we're already seeing it. We're seeing improved services, we're seeing a better reach of services, and we're seeing, you know, that sort of tangible example there, you know, for MoneyPlace, circa $5,500 is sort of what our borrowers are saving. I think you're seeing that. Now, the question then is, though, is what's the penetration and what's the actual impact that's happening there? And I think that's sort of where you sit there and say, meh, kind of evens out. So, you know, MoneyPlace, RateSetter, Society1, three largest sort of marketplace lenders in the consumer lending space, collectively have combined books of less than $1 billion. $1 billion is generous in terms of rounding. Overall, that's less than 1% of consumer lending in Australia. Is that really meaningful? Is that material in terms of impact? No, it's not. But is it getting there? Yes, it is. Would you like $5,500? Probably. And I think that kind of gets to it. But then also, if you look behind that and you say, well, what else is happening? Rate said it was the first company to participate in comprehensive credit reporting. MoneyPlace was the second. Society1 then followed a few months later. So it's the fintechs that are actually leading on things, on policies that get to better customer outcomes around CCR, for example, open banking is something we're dealing with now, versus an industry of the major banks that sat there on their hands for the last 10 years and didn't do anything. So I think you're going to see benefit. It's just we're not that year, not yet there in terms of critical mass.
Oh, well, I'm sceptical. We haven't been through a cycle and we haven't been through hard times. I mean, in Australia, you probably, some of you anyway, will remember that building societies were much bigger players in the financial system in the 70s and early 80s, but disappeared. Insurance companies did lots of lending in Australia in the 1920s, but disappeared from the market. It's going to be interesting to see how this evolves and the extent to which it gets internalised within existing players, and they'll do things differently. But it's very early days. I mean, who really knows? But history, as I showed in my chart, has suggested there have been a whole range of innovations over 140 years, and ultimately the insiders have captured them.
We've heard a lot about the bank and the payments. I've got a question popped up here about insurance. How do you see the insurance companies using fintech? Open question there for any of you. Eric?
I think in insurance we've seen on some of the stats is certainly an area that's growing. It's got a bit of ground to make up to payments and those types of things. But the indications are generally there. A lot of it is being pioneered overseas. The health insurance industry is very strong in it. Some of the other, car insurance and those types of things are catching up, often with behavioural monitoring, telematics and those types of things. A couple of insurance areas, life insurance is probably one that's a little bit further behind, certainly in this market, but overseas as well. Absolutely. I think it's coming.
Again, I'm a long-term sceptic. If we knew everything about you, would we be able to insure you? No. Exactly. So that's what worries me about big data and insurance. Insurance depends upon pooling, and pooling depends upon not knowing the precise characteristics of all of the individuals in the pool. And so I'm pretty sceptical. In the long run, I think there will be many intermediate gains, but I think insurance has got a deep problem.
Royal Commission is obviously topical. Stuart's enjoying it. We have a question here about what the Royal Commission, if anything, should do. Is it the Royal Commission's place to make sure that the insiders don't get all of the benefits of fintech?
I think it depends on how you frame insiders and what you sort of do in terms of defining the benefit. Royal Commission's sort of purview is very much to look at misbehaviour in sort of traditional financial services, and we're seeing that. What I think then follows from that is well, then the so what? What does that then mean? There was another question that came up around open banking. Open banking is up for debate now. The Treasurer has indicated clearly that this is something that he believes is important and would like to be done as a matter of priority. Royal Commission round one talked about responsible lending. Responsible lending in the way that the issues were incurred, sort of it was highlighted by the Royal Commission, is it's really hard to understand whether or not you're lending responsibly to a borrower if you don't understand the borrower. Open banking eliminates that problem. If I, as a lender, have access to transactional information that enables me to sort of reconstruct your financial position and determine what your affordability is of a loan, I can fulfill my requirements around responsible lending by looking at that data. And I think what you see is a number of fintechs are already doing this, which is leaps and bounds ahead of traditional banks and traditional lenders. And so I think what you'll see is that fintech, while not necessarily under the spotlight in the Royal Commission, potentially points to a number of things that are being done that could alleviate challenges that are currently being highlighted by Royal Commission. Yeah. A lot of that gets to what's going to be put forward in open banking. Flagged earlier, I don't think there was anybody from CBA in the audience. CBA is taking a leading position in open banking by releasing 19 million customer files on data tapes that they left somewhere. You know, so it's great to see our largest bank sharing customer information.
I think,
thanks, Stu.
Again, I think it depends a lot with the Royal Commission. I mean, we're talking about a bunch of lawyers, and so they're going to make more laws. I think that's almost certainly going to be the recommendation, set of recommendations, and a set of additional laws probably means a whole lot more regulation and compliance and a whole lot more costs, and it's not clear that will play to the advantage of entrants as opposed to large established firms. So I think that's the danger with the Royal Commission, not clear as a bunch of lawyers that they will think outside using the law as their main tool, and that's probably a negative for the sector we're talking about.
Academic bags on lawyers to a room full of actuaries, crowd goes wild. Yay.
So we've talked a little about fintechs as opposed to traditional players, but to what extent do you all expect the traditional players to disrupt themselves, as we hear, and can they be successful? Can the traditional players run a good fintech operation?
Oh, look, I think we'll without a doubt see more partnering between fintechs and established players. I think most established players, you know, either already do that in our market, or we'll need to do it in order to capture some, you know, some of the customer experience advantages that fintechs are carving out, which I think are undeniable from a experience point of view, from a broader societal level. I guess the jury's out on that, but I think there will certainly be more partnering. I think in many instances the legacy systems are holding the banks back, but they will find ways around that. I think.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I think you're definitely already seeing some great examples of incumbents partnering with fintechs. MoneyPlace is a great example of that. I mentioned before, a marketplace lender. Majority of our investors are banks, credit unions or regional banks that will invest money through. We've recently done a partnership with Liberty Financial, who have come in as a major investor. We'll be taking our personal loans via Liberty's broker network and looking to do to the personal loan space what Liberty did to the mortgage space 20 years ago. And so you see partnerships in that sort of way that are forming. They're very much relationship-based and about that sort of individual transaction. But also you see investments from banks. So NAB has NAB Labs and their innovation team. Westpac has Reinventure. ANZ's doing similar things by hiring their former head of Google in Australia and bringing Amelia onto the board. CBA is doing some things around the edges as well. And what that gets to is banks recognise. Now, the challenge, to be fair, and I realise I just spent 15 minutes bagging banks, is it is incredibly hard. You've got complex systems, you've got old legacy systems, but also it's not necessarily a bank's job to be on the cutting edge of innovation. A bank is sort of there to deliver a service. You can argue if it's a service or a utility, but also to deliver returns to shareholders. And it's not necessarily for banks to be able to put it all on black and say, hey, we're going to go out and use XYZ technology. I think you're going to see that sort of the emergence of those types of partnerships is going to become more and more prominent, particularly as banks recognise that, hey, this innovation is happening and this company over here is doing amazing things. Well, let's partner with them. And that gets to a self-awareness as well from the banks of saying, we don't necessarily need to do it ourselves. Superannuation is a really interesting area for that in terms of, from a superannuation funds perspective, how could you partner with a fintech and what services could a fintech potentially bring? If I'm at a bank, I'm not necessarily worried about what a fintech is going to do. I'm not worried about what MoneyPlace is going to do. I'm worried about what happens if a number of superannuation funds partner with MoneyPlace and bring a personal loan, or partner with XYZ and bring a small business loan or a mortgage to my customer base. Mike Starkey, who's ex-NAB, just launched... they announced their mortgage product that they're launching. I think they're Atheum Capital or something to that effect. Basically, what they've done is they're launching a mortgage product that's targeting Australian borrowers. that's going to be funded by a couple of superannuation funds. That's pretty powerful. And the superannuation funds are already funding the mortgage anyway via a complicated network of deals across the markets that, you know, ultimately result in bank balance sheet funding. But that's actually pretty cool. What happens if you cut out the middleman? And what would happen if that super fund was to open its member base up to a special mortgage offer that was being made available to those members? And what does that do to create value?
And time's running out, so we're going to leave you with that thought. Please join me in thanking Eric, Stuart, and Rod.